I did have an introduction. You just missed it. But I began to lose sleep because of what the topic was. What should every Christian know? What does Jeremy Mitchell in 40 minutes, 30 minutes want to say from his heart that is important enough to say that every Christian needs to know this? And so I began to struggle with it. I began to try to figure out what that would be. And I do have a problem. You know, I come here from a different perspective. I come here not necessarily from a pulpit. I'm not a full-time pulpit minister. I am a recovery minister, which means I deal with people that are in struggling with their sin. I deal with people that are downtrodden, that are looked over, that people push on to somebody else. And that is the ministry that I deal with. And so when I come to a wonderful congregation filled with my brothers and sisters in Christ, I have to sit there and I have to think, what do I and the people of this congregation have in common? And I know what we have in common. Life is hard, isn't it? Life is hard. Life is so hard. I've actually seen people at Walmart. I love Walmart. Do y'all like Walmart? Because you see all kind of people in there. And I caught on to a new fad recently. These people that spend a lot of time exercising, they have T-shirts now that say, "The struggle is real." And when I look at them, I start chuckling to myself. I was like, you have no idea how real the struggle is. And the struggle goes obviously way beyond the weight room, doesn't it? In fact, as Christians, we should be very intimate with that thought process, that life is struggle. Denying yourself, picking up your cross daily. He who wants to save his own life will lose it, but he who is willing to lose his own life for my sake will find it. These things are struggles. And so how do we deal with the struggle of life? How do we deal with the hardships of life? How do we persevere is the real question, isn't it? I began to really think about this process, and I started teaching a series at the recovery center where I work to people that are either reconnecting with God, rebuilding that relationship with Him, or they're learning for the first time. And it's one thing, the theme of this this series is being unreasonable, living an unreasonable life. In fact, we were just having a conversation, me and Mr. Hall, about being unreasonable. We were talking about our country. We were talking about the economy. We were talking about the culture. We were talking about India. We were talking about the jail ministry that you do and that others are involved in. That's unreasonable. In fact, Jesus was unreasonable, wasn't he? And so were the apostles. Need I remind you that when Jesus was here, he hung out with people that most people didn't want around. Rough around the edges, fishermen, cheating tax collectors, women with not the best of reputations were coming and washing his feet with her hair. The who's who of society, he tended to have a problem with them and wanted to teach them about the errors of their ways. Jesus was an unreasonable man, wasn't he? He'd touch lepers. He'd heal the blind. The lame walked again. He'd raise the dead. He chased animals out of the temple and confronted the masses. He willingly went to a death that he did not owe from our viewpoint. He died for a bunch of people that did not accept him. So he was unreasonable. And in this lifestyle in America, in our human existence, in this culture, in order to be Christians, we have to be unreasonable. We have to be unreasonable because Jesus calls us to be unreasonable. In fact, he's so unreasonable that one of his apostles, James, he wrote a book. Now, it's one of my favorite letters. The reason why it is one of my favorite letters is because what I do The very first verse, it says, James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes of the dispersion, in the dispersion. Now, this is imagery dealing with the Old Testament to talk about God's people. 12 tribes of the dispersion is talking about after the persecution in Jerusalem, and they're heading out into the world, and now they have no home. They have no country. They are different. They're set apart. They're children of God. They're members of the kingdom of heaven. People are pursuing them to take their lives. In fact, Saul was one of them who later became Paul, that made a profession out of locking up Christians and killing them. And so that's who he's dealing with. He's dealing with the people that are the outcast. And the very first thing that comes out of his mouth in James verse 2, he says, "Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." That's interesting, isn't it? Right out the gate, James calls us to be unreasonable. He said, "Count it all joy when you face trials of many kinds." Joy. He didn't say, "Be okay with it if you can. Try not to complain." No, he said, "Consider it joy. Rejoice. And again, I tell you, rejoice." But why? Why be joyful? Why be unreasonable? Why look forward to the trial? Because trials are difficult. We're not supposed to look forward to the trial, but God tells us to through James. He says, "Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet these trials. So for you know the testing of your faith." The testing of your faith produces steadfastness. Now, steadfastness. That's what we're looking for, right? It's through our faith, through our belief in God, through our assuredness in what we don't see, through our hope in what we're promised, that steadfastness is created. And when I think of steadfastness, one thing that I think about is these guys that do MMA fighting and they do boxing and different forms of reft, hand-to-hand combat events. And one of the most important things, if you can tell when you're watching one of these matches, is their positioning, how they're holding their feet. It is their stance. It's being sure-footed so that they can stand the onslaught of pain and discomfort, so that they can see it through to the end. They're not bouncing around trying to dodge the hits, so to speak, but they're preparing for what's fixing to come so that they can act accordingly. It's the same thing. That sure-footedness is the same thing as steadfastness. He's telling you, be sure-footed. Be steadfast. Be consistent. Stand firm when you meet a trial. It says, and let that steadfastness, that sure-footedness, that will have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. He said, don't give up, don't give in. You've got to see it through to the end. And how difficult is that, right? How difficult is it for us to see things to the end? When things start to hurt, we tend to bow out. We tend to try to find an easier, softer way. We create plan B's and plan C's for these situations. That's our culture. Our culture has taught us that. But if we remember, he said, the way you can stand firm in the storm of life, and yes, it is a storm, and you will have storms. I had a friend of mine tell me, he said, pretty much what he has learned about life in his 60-plus years is either you're going into a storm, you're in a storm, or you're coming out of a storm. Those are your three positions. He says, if you want to be perfect, complete, lacking in nothing, the beginning of it's faith. And you're probably thinking, well, yeah, Jeremy, it's always faith. It's always faith, right? We talk about faith all the time. We talk about it all the time. Do we really act in it? If we turn to Matthew chapter 17, Jesus, in his unreasonable ways, gives us some insight to it. And for a while there, it was discouraging to me. Matthew chapter 17, verses 20 through 21. I'll give you all a second to go through it. Matthew chapter 17, verse 20 and 21. He said to them, "Because of your little faith, for truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." This is Jesus. I have a red letter Bible, and when I just read that, it's in red, which means Jesus said it, which means God said it, because in John chapter 1, it tells us that Jesus is God. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So God said it. He said, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed. I don't know if y'all have ever seen a mustard seed, but if I had it in my hand, it'd just be a little speck, and you probably wouldn't be able to see it from where you're sitting. And I apologize, I did not bring a PowerPoint because I like to be a little bit old-fashioned. Three-piece suits and a steno pad and a Bible is the way I prefer it. So I did not bring the bells and whistles with me, just the Word. But it's a really tiny, tiny seed. And you know, I grew up in the church. I grew up at Mayfair. I now a member of Central Church of Christ, and I've read that 1,000 times, probably more than that. And for me, that was really frustrating because I didn't think I'd moved any mountains. I live in Huntsville. In Huntsville, we have Montesano Mountain, Chapman Mountain, Green Mountain, all kind of mountains. We're surrounded by mountains. But you know what? Those mountains have been in the exact same place my entire life. If I take this text strictly from a literal perspective, it creates an issue for me. But probably about 2 years ago in my studies, I came across somebody that helped me understand this text a little bit better. And the man's last name is Manjihi. I can't pronounce his first name. It's interesting that I'm bringing this up because y'all are involved in India ministries, right? Well, Manjihi was a man from India in the early 1900s. He was a poor, illiterate farmer on the side of a mountain, just a little rural community. And the hospital was on the other side of the mountain. And in order to get to the hospital or to the biggest town, it was a windy, treacherous, one-lane road that was 80 kilometers to that village. And one day, Manjihi's wife got hurt or became ill. I cannot remember which one it was, but it was a serious situation. And so Manjihi got her in the truck, and he headed down this windy road. Well, unfortunately, while Manjihi was trying to get his wife to people that could help her, she passed away. And since we've all been on this earth for a little while, I think we can understand the pain of losing a loved one. I have never lost a wife to death, but I can imagine that it is an extremely painful process. I'm sure that the grieving is tremendous. Remember, life is hard. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, when you face trials of many kinds. Manjihi was faced with this trial, with this grief. And he went through a period of time where he was grieving. And at some point, Manjihi made a decision. He made a decision. He was unreasonable. Manjihi was unreasonable. You know what he did? He went outside and picked up a shovel and went to that mountain. And he started to dig. Well, he obviously wasn't the only person in this village. And they would tease him, make fun of him, say, well, he's just illiterate. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's lost his mind since his wife's died. He's crazy. Well, he kept digging. Kept digging. Year after year after year. In the information that you can find on Manjihi, it says that eventually his neighbors, the people of the village, started to bring him food. Hopefully they had a pizza night, because it was pretty good here. They started bringing him food. They started also bringing him tools, but nobody ever helped him dig in this mountain. And after 22 years of digging, Manjihi reached the other side. Manjihi cutted the distance to the hospital from 80 kilometers to 15 kilometers. And it was wide enough for a two-lane road. And he's known to have saved his village's life. And in the history books, Manjihi will forever be known as the Mountain Man. Manjihi made a decision that, yes, he did lose his wife, but he wasn't going to let it happen again. Manjihi faced a trial with joy. Didn't say happiness, did it? With joy, and persevered. Manjihi will be known for the rest of India's existence as the Mountain Man. Now, if he had not persevered, if he did not continue, he would have never been known as anything more than a poor, illiterate farmer. Even if he put 10 years worth of effort into it, if he'd have quit, they just looked at him like he was a fool. But he persevered. It says, your steadfastness helps you get to completeness. And it starts with faith. Now, I don't know what Manjihi had faith in. I have no idea. History books don't say. But I know that his faith, whatever he had faith in, gave him the intellect to understand that sometimes you got to pick up a shovel. Sometimes. See, the thing is, the reason why we can't persevere is because we don't understand that our steadfastness that's created by faith also involves work. In fact, James talks about it, doesn't he? I'll go back to James here. Just as a little added emphasis, it'd be James chapter 2. I'm going to be starting in 18, verse 18. He says, but some will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. You believe that God is one, you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. You want to be shown, you foolish person, that faith apart from works is useless. When you face trials, guys, finding joy in a trial and finding the purpose of the trial starts with faith. The Bible is stocked full of verses and communications that say faith also involves action. In fact, if you take time to study James, you will understand that faith comes from a level of knowledge, right? You hear the word first, then you come to believe. And in James, knowledge is not a collection of data. Simply, you know, I go to college at Heritage Christian University, and that's how we got in contact. And I know that your preacher is a graduate of Heritage Christian University. And in that process, you know, I collect data, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. but it's useless if I don't use it. She needs to burp, doesn't she? No? It's useless if I don't use it. Knowledge is meant to create action. Knowledge creates faith. Through faith, you act. He says, belief is not enough. Even the demons believe. The demons believe, but they're not going where we're going. You can't just say, oh yeah, I have faith for this to work out, and then go do this right here. And just hang out. That's not the way it works. It's not the way it works. You've got to put in your work. It's not time to be lazy. When you are having a hard time in life, that's the time to get to work. And you've got to persevere. You've got to work as long as it takes. He said, you've got to persevere to the end so that you can be complete, lacking in nothing. That's what it says, right? Mon Jehe did 22 years of the same thing. He didn't do 5 months. He did 22 years. He did it till it was complete. Get to work. You can't have faith without works. There's no such thing as faith and tired. Elijah got tired and he ran to a cave. God showed himself in a whisper after a lot of dramatic things like a fire and a wind and an earthquake. And he cried to God, and basically he was tired, wasn't he? He said, they're trying, everybody else is dead. I'm all alone. I'm all by myself. So God gave him some other people to help him work. He didn't retire at that point. He didn't go sit down on the couch. You've got to do something to deal with this problem. The interesting thing is that God tells us we have everything we need. In 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 and 4, it says, in His divine nature, it's in God in His nature has given us everything for life and godliness through the growing knowledge of Him. He gave us everything we need. We need this. We need to spend time with this. And just from talking to Mr. Hall here for a little bit, I already understand that you have an excellent preacher. But I want to promise you, you need to do more than what Robert Hall's doing for you. You need to put in your own work. Mon Jehe had people feeding him. Mon Jehe had people giving him tools. Guess what? They'll feed you here. The Word of God, they'll give you the tools. Robert Hall will stand in here and give you the tools, tell you how to do it. But you got to get to work. You see, he can't dig on your mountain. You have to. And there's another really interesting element to what we have going on here in James chapter 1, which is pretty much where I'm staying. And this is why it's unreasonable. There is no other way. And I'm fixing to show you this. Look at verse 12. He says, blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial. You have the same language that you had in verse 2. For when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. If you just stay in it, you're rewarded. If you stay in it, you're rewarded. That's what this says. But here's the kicker. In verse 13, it says, let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's fully grown, brings forth. Now, I talked about going to college, and basically I do a collection of data while I'm there. I'm learning how to study is basically what they're teaching me. But that education is useless if I don't use it. So let me use it real quick. Now, I'm not going to get into a bunch of nerdy things here, but I do want to explain to you one thing that I found interesting about this text. In the Koine Greek in which this New Testament is originally written, the Greek word for trial and the Greek word for temptation are the same. It's the same word. Okay? The same word. So, obviously, that makes me have a lot of really silly questions come up in my head, like, why did they put temptation here and they put trial there? Why did they not use the same word? And as we look at this, what you will come to find out is, it's where's God at? Tempted and tried, have you let God in? Have you let God in? That's the difference. If you look at the very first one, God is all through verses 2 and 4. You count it joy because you're meeting trials. It's testing your faith. That creates steadfastness. When it's done, you're complete, lacking in nothing. You're perfect. God is in there. In verse 12, it says, blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, right? Trial. When he has stood the test, he receives a crown of life. God's in that. It's very interesting that right after that, the same word, it says, let no one say he is tempted. I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he's lured and enticed by his own desire. His own desire. And that, edited, leads to death. God's not in that. In fact, I told y'all I'm in recovery ministry, and I'll give you a great example. When a man struggles with getting sober and following Christ, and he's presented with an opportunity to get high or get drunk, and he succeeds, he comes and tells me the trial that he had and what God did for him. Believe it or not, that's exactly what they do. Every one of them, whether they're Christian or not, that's what they do. But the man that gets presented with that same thing and ends up getting high, what they said to me, I was tempted. The temptation was too much for me. The reason is because they went after their own selfish desires. See, it does take faith. Because when you hit that situation, you've got to have faith that God is going to work this out. All things work together for good for those who love the Lord and are called according to His purpose. So why do we forget that, Romans 8:28? Why do we forget that when bad things happen? What? Did you think that God is not going to keep good on His promise? Is that what we're saying when we decide to, when things get hard, we're going to go handle it, go do our own thing because we're tired and discouraged? Is that what we're doing? Or do we think we know how to deal with this better than God does? Could that be it? Because it says out of your own evil desires, right? That creates death. It says there are ways that seem good to a man that lead to death. This is Bible, folks. We're New Testament Christians. This is what we hinge our lives on. It's funny, in Titus, in chapter 1, verse 2, it says, in the God who never lies. It takes faith. It takes faith and work. A faith that creates action. A faith that causes a man to pick up a shovel and start digging on the sin problem that he has. Trusting in God, not trying to hide it. Mind you, he didn't do this in the dark. He was made fun of. He was ridiculed. He was ostracized. But we have a hard time going up in front at church, right? Talk to the eldership, the preacher, tell them we got a lying problem or an anger problem. We have problems with this, right? Because we're worried about what other people think. It doesn't talk about what other people think. It talks about, are you being faithful to God? Are you allowing God to be God and you to be you? Or are you saying, you know what, God, I've got this. I'm going to go do what I want because this way, the way you have me going through it, it is way too hard. Way too hard, God. I have found a plan B and we're going to do this plan B and we're going to work it out that way. So when you're in crunch time at your work and your boss is really, I mean, he's just all over you and people are getting laid off and you're having a problem. And it's a trial that says, well, God, I trust you except for my job because, you know, your word says work as if you're working for the Lord. But if I do that, then the numbers aren't going to work out right and I could lose my job. So I'm going to sit over here. I'm going to come over here and compromise. Or you're having a hard time in a relationship and you decide to seek counsel from the other sex because it's hard. I don't want to have to deal with it. He knows what he's doing, doesn't he? Praise God, because I'd have gone for another 30 minutes. Here's the thing. Life is hard. It's hard. It doesn't say we might be tested. It says we are going to be tested. This is not prosperity gospel. I'm not going to tell you you're going to be healthy, wealthy, and well-fed. We're all way too intelligent for that. We've read the text. We understand what it says. Be faithful. Put a little sweat into it. Be steadfast. Work on it. Understand, you need to be in the right position. You need to let God be God and you be you. Because if you don't, you're going to end up going in the wrong direction. No matter if it seems good at the beginning, it's going to end up poorly. And here pretty soon, you know everybody's going to come in here and I'm going to stand back up and give an invitation. And I encourage you at that time. I don't know who is who in here. I don't have a clue. I found out I had some family to go here. But if y'all need to deal with that, that will be the time. I appreciate y'all letting me come and spend this hour with you. I appreciate the fact that y'all fed me. The hospitality is overwhelming. And I will never forget y'all, and I look forward to the next time.